We're talking to Frank Morgan, a longtime resident of New Mexico, who actually was born in a couple days before Christmas back in 1933, and had a very exciting life beginning shortly thereafter. So, Frank, you want to say anything about your home life, about your parents, about your dad, Stanley Morgan, the guitar player?
Well, my dad was a guitarist, a jazz guitarist, who was a friend of Charlie Parker's, and you know, and most of the you know, legendary cats, including Louis Armstrong, and exposed me to all the music that he possibly could. At 7 years old, he took me to hear the J. McShann Band. And although I was a guitar player up until I was seven, because my father was teaching me, but when Charlie Parker stood up to take his first solo, my father said that I said to him, "That's it for the guitar, pops. You know, that's what I want to play." And I was lucky enough that he knew Charlie Parker well, and he took me backstage. And the next day, Charlie Parker insisted I start on clarinet, which I was really, you know, kind of mad with him about that, but the greater wisdom, you know, became available to me later on, you know, because I see that the clarinet helped me a lot in forming an armature and knowing that you had to keep your face muscles in order to play your, you know, instrument right. And a number of other things that have just been a great thing in my lifetime, you know.
So I guess we could say Charlie Parker was an early mentor of yours heading you in the right direction on the clarinet. You jumped to the alto a couple of years later.
After going to soprano saxophone first, my teacher in Milwaukee, a beautiful man named Leonard Gay, introduced me to the alto saxophone, because you know he had one and he let me use it, and it was very similar to the clarinet, and it was great for my armature, and that lasted maybe a year and a half, and then I got my first alto. And it's been sheer joy ever since.
And so basically you were a full-time alto player by the time you made it out to L.A. in the late 40s, 1947 or something like that?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Although at that time I still played clarinet. But, you know, like, unlike now, I don't play any of the, even soprano, which I love, you know, but... in order to get the personal sound on the alto that I want, you know, or to continue to approach that personal sound.
Do you still have a soprano?
No. I would be tempted to practice it too much. But I mean, I'm a single-minded guy, and I think that for me, the quest of you know, getting what I can out of the alto saxophone requires, you know, the full attention, you know. It's just like the alto saxophone required that I stop going to prison if I was going to play that well, you know.
Did you have an axe in prison most of the time?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we can get to...
Otherwise, I would have escaped, you know. Yeah.
Okay. Well, no, we can get to that in a minute, but no, I wanted to talk a little bit about your teenage years in L.A. there. So if you got there in 47, that must have been kind of the height of the Central Avenue Renaissance after the war.
Well, it was really exciting, you know, especially to a 13, 14-year-old, you know, because the... it was a mini 52nd Street, because like, within the two block area of Central Avenue, there were about five clubs that were featuring jazz, you know. And it was great. I mean, jam sessions all night, which I couldn't take advantage of that part of it, you know, because I was too young. But they had some beautiful jam sessions on Sunday afternoons. And, you know, I could go to those. And it was just a great scene. And incidentally, I was just in L.A. A few weeks ago playing at the Jazz Bakery with John Hicks. And I went over to the Leimert Park area where Billy Higgins had his world stage, which is still there and functioning. And within the two blocks of there had about four or five jazz venues, you know, even in Leimert Park. And I mean, really, the jazz scene is really happening in L.A. You know?
Oh, well, that's great to hear.
Yeah,
it's actually livening up a little bit here in Albuquerque, for that matter.
Yeah,
so basically, you met Charlie Parker in 1940 in Detroit, and he helped you start on the clarinet. Did you have much contact with him before you got out there to L.A. in 47? If I remember correctly, 1947 would have been about the time he got out of his stay in Camarillo.
Well, initially, I didn't have the time with him in L.A. Until maybe the early 50s, you know, around the same time that Chet Baker worked with him at the Tiffany, I guess it was, with Lawrence Marable. And
was that something that Gene Norman sponsored out there, the music at the Tiffany?
Yeah, well, he sponsored the jam sessions before, and I don't remember whether he was responsible for bringing Charlie Parker there.
Another thing I read that you told Gary Giddens about was back in 55 when Bird died, you were on the bandstand with Dexter Gordon and Wardell Gray and Gene Ammons and maybe Hampton Hawes and a couple other guys, and when you got word that Bird had passed and that you guys took a break to commemorate his passing, how did that work out?
Well, it happened, you know. We just basically we did what what, you know, they had been doing for quite some time, and I was beginning to do. We just went and got high, you know. But that was kind of then, and this is now, you know.
Okay.
And I'd like to you know, focus on the now. I mean, I got some beautiful things that are happening in my life, and I'm 71 years old.
Yeah. I mean, actually, you're. Everything that you've done since summer in Santa Fe at the Chamber Music Festival has been a busy and impressive schedule. The Jazz Bakery and the Jazz Standard. And
yeah.
How did your recording session with Rudy Van Gelder go?
Oh, that was a dream, man. I mean, you know, I didn't know, man, that, you know, that I mean, you had to be invited to his studio, you know. I mean, to pay to record there. You had to be invited to, you know, he just doesn't do it for everybody. And it's one of the most fantastic places I've ever been in my life. And he is so focused, you know.
Well, he's certainly created some great recordings over the years.
Yeah, you know, he told me that he had been waiting a long time, you know, to get, you know, to work with me just as much as I had, you know, been waiting, you know, for him. You know, he wanted to see what he could do with my sound, that's great. I mean, it's just a, you know, it's just a joy being there, and I'm looking forward. That's going to be released before the third part of the series, live at the Jazz Standard, you know.
Oh, wow, so you're actually going to get three recordings out of that weekend at the Standard.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And who did you go into the studio with? Did I remember, was it Ronnie Matthews you went in there with?
Yeah, Ronnie Matthews, Essiet, African bass player, and Billy Hart, of course, you know.
Yeah, actually, I want to throw a few musicians' names at you before we're through here. Some guys who, it seems to me, have played with you a lot and meant a lot to you. I just wanted to jump back a little bit and say, did you want to say anything about your dad's club in L.A., the Casablanca, or what that experience was like, or actually what became of your dad?
Well, my dad passed several years ago in Hawaii, still working as the leader of Stanley Morgan's world famous Ink Spots.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he played right up till his death. And one of his ashes sprinkled near Waikiki, you know. It was great. Because I was able to be there, and, you know, when he sprinkled the ashes, and that was my introduction to Hawaii, you know, which I love dearly to this day, but it's just so far, you know.